From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA senior TV correspondent Chris Simpkins. February is Black History Month in the United States, a time to celebrate the achievements by African Americans, as well as an opportunity to take stock of setbacks in the quest for greater racial equality. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Professor Justin Hansford, Associate Professor of Law and Executive Director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center at Howard University here in Washington. He was previously a Democracy Project Fellow at Harvard University, a visiting professor of law at Georgetown University, and an associate professor of law at St. Louis University. Professor Hansford is a leading scholar and activist in the areas of critical race theory, human rights, and law and social movements. We'll talk with Professor Hansford about a range of issues, including the racially tinged controversies in Virginia politics and the resurgence of white supremacy in the United States. We will also acknowledge and celebrate the emergence of several African-American political leaders. Two of the most prominent American politicians running for president in 2020, Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey and Senator Kamala Harris of California, are African-American. And the U.S. Congress has more people of color serving, at least 52, than ever before. And we'll discuss these and related issues with our guest, Professor Justin Hansford, who joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Professor Hansford, welcome to the program.
All right. Glad to be here.
And I'm always delighted to welcome my colleague, Chris Simpkins.
Thanks for having me again, Carol.
Well, Professor Hansford, let me ask you a question about your background. What prompted you to enter the field of law to begin with and specializing in race and human rights?
Well, it's an issue that is near and dear to my heart. I was a young man who was deeply moved by reading a book called The Autobiography of Malcolm X when I was a teenager. That had a great deal of influence on me and encouraged me to read about African-American history. And the desire to go into law, and in particular civil rights law, I think emerged out of my appreciation for history and the opportunity to use the law to promote social change and try to make history as opposed to just studying history as well. So I consider myself both an activist and a professor because I study all of the different social change movements that have emerged on issues of human rights and civil rights. And I also try to participate in it with our Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center at Howard University.
In addition to Malcolm X, are there other prominent African-Americans who have inspired you?
Definitely. So Thurgood Marshall was the first African-American Supreme Court justice. And we've named our Civil Rights Center at Howard after Thurgood Marshall, in part because he's an alumni of our school. So it's always good to cheer for the home team. But also, he is someone who had a longstanding dedication to equal justice under law. And he did more than simply litigate cases and make a difference in the courts. He also engaged in supporting people in the civil rights movement on the streets by representing protesters. He also represented people who were wrongfully accused of crimes in the Jim Crow South. And he's someone who represents the best of what we aspire to be as future civil rights lawyers at Howard. So we're very happy to have his name on our center and to promote his legacy.
Let me turn to Chris for a question.
Justin, hardly a day goes by when we don't hear in the newspaper, read in the newspaper, or see on cable television instances of racial injustice, friction, double standards, police brutality, the Confederate flag, congressmen defending white nationalists. Is this surprising to you, the amount of coverage we see now that is devoted to focusing on racial injustice?
Not at all. So I consider myself a critical race theorist, and this philosophy, which is a philosophy of race in America, it prescribes that throughout American history, you know, it's been 400 years since African Americans have been on American shores. Throughout our history, we've seen what we call reform and retrenchment on the issues of race. So what we mean by that is if you go back even to the Civil War period, after slavery ended, We had a period of Reconstruction. The first black senators, congresspeople were elected. Then, after that reform, we saw retrenchment. The Ku Klux Klan did not always exist. It existed as a movement in response to the gains that African Americans made after they were emancipated. We saw the rise of lynching. We saw the rise of Jim Crow, which again did not exist before the Civil War. This was something that was constructed later on in the 19th century. So by retrenchment, we mean a step back. And we've seen that throughout our history. Once again, after the Civil Rights Movement in the 20th century with Martin Luther King and the NAACP making great strides. And so after the election of the first African-American president, Barack Obama, it's not surprising to see a form of retrenchment in the sense of a desire to take steps back on issues of representation, on issues of symbolism, because the symbolism of having an African-American president is in many quarters something which gives people pause. And so it's not surprising at all to see the retrenchment. I think the issue is how will we be able to respond to that retrenchment without losing sight of our aspirations to make positive change. We have to do more than simply fend off attacks, whether it's through the Unite the Right rallies and Charlottesville and these other uses of blackface. We can't simply occupy our time responding to negativity. We also, as activists and scholars, need to continue to focus in a forward-thinking way on making positive change. And so that's really our challenge.
Would you agree that in less than two generations, the United States has been transformed itself from a largely racist society to a largely non-racist one?
No, I don't agree with that. If you look at the Jim Crow period, this was a period of widespread discrimination in what we call a de jure sense. As lawyers, we talk about discrimination in the law, where fountains were marked blacks only or whites only. And so this was one particular type of segregation, which was particularly symbolic in the sense that the names and terms used were in your face. Today, with things like mass incarceration, with the disparities we've seen in police violence, there are similar disparities. And in fact, if you look at economic trends, the gap on an economic level has not changed significantly between not today and two generations ago. When it comes to the percentage of black poverty, I think almost 40% of African-American children live in poverty today. And during the Jim Crow years, we may have had 50%. So it's not an overwhelming difference in terms of poverty rates and other types of economic indicators. There has been some improvement, but it's not so much that I would say that we've emerged from the pattern of reform and retrenchment, where there's been steps forward followed by steps back.
What other factors account for this, in your view, some of these statistics which seem not to have improved for the African-American community, maybe taking other forms, mass incarceration, like you said, we're seeing incidences of police brutality.
Right.
What other factors besides, you know, racism would you point to?
We should understand what we mean when we say racism. I think very few people understand the term in a specific way. As a lawyer, I focus more on structural racism. So racism to me is not primarily a question of somebody having a negative attitude towards an African American on a personal level, or even using a negative term to describe them, or engaging in stereotype. The bigger problem for me is when race is used as a mechanism to determine positive or negative outcomes for communities. For example, in terms of housing segregation, when police officers try to get involved in drug enforcement, they may choose neighborhoods that are highly impoverished, which are overwhelmingly African American. So while college students in their dorms can use lots of marijuana without having somebody as an undercover or a SWAT team swoop into their neighborhood and haul them all away to jail, in the housing projects, you don't have that opportunity. The same behavior will have a much different outcome. And that's racially inflected. And so where the college dorms are primarily not as diverse as we'd like to see, and the housing projects are more diverse. And so to me, that's the racism I'm concerned about, the structural racism and what an individual thinks in terms of their attitude towards another individual doesn't have the large scale impact that structural racism does. And so that's the problem that we face today in America.
There's been a lot written about the feeling that rural white Americans feel like a minority group, that they feel invisible at times. But this kind of idea is hard to reconcile with the fact that black and Latino Americans still trail white Americans in terms of wealth, income, and educational attainment. How do we change this narrative in thinking among white people who see themselves now as a minority?
I think that's a very interesting phenomena. I think that in many ways, members of those communities, specifically white Americans and middle America, they do have many concerns that are not effectively addressed in the political system. But I think what is significant is that in spite of those concerns, overwhelmingly, if you look at what has happened politically, you think about the last political election, the candidates that they were led to support were the ones that gave them an option either to solve your problems through things like building a wall or things like creating a division between others who are causing your problems. Or if you think about some of the other options that focus less on identity and more on economics, increase wages or have free access to healthcare. And so they were given these stark choices. And I think too often we have seen these communities, when forced to choose, they've embraced the desire of circling the wagons amongst themselves as the solution to their problems. They have not had an opportunity to take advantage of the more economically progressive options, because those options are lumped together with many diverse communities. You know, so if you wanted to say, for example, embrace more access to healthcare, you'd also have to embrace the Democratic Party, which has been described as, you know, pro-affirmative action, pro-welfare. Because of this mix, people are given few options. And so they're giving few shades of subtlety with which to make their political decisions. That's a big problem.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Professor Justin Hansford. He's an associate professor of law and the executive director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center at Howard University here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA senior TV correspondent Chris Simpkins. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout-out to a longtime listener and Facebook fan, Nelson Azuma from Tema, Ghana. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our guest in honor of Black History Month, Justin Hansford. Justin, let's talk about the so-called Trump era. Under President Trump, many have observed what appears to be an uptick in anti-minority sentiment, even hate crimes. And these obviously disproportionately affect minorities, African-Americans, Jews. We've seen incidents from the massacre at the synagogue in Pittsburgh prior to that, Charlottesville, where you had Ku Klux Klan, white nationalists marching against anti-racism protesters. To what extent do you see any kind of correlation with the current administration and the occupant in the Oval Office?
That's an interesting question. I think there is certainly a climate that embraces this idea that it is politically correct and therefore wrongheaded to embrace notions of diversity. And so this conflation of political correctness has created a climate where some people feel emboldened to speak out about their stereotypes or their positions on people of Jewish descent or ethnic minorities in America. I actually think it's a mistake to attribute it necessarily to one individual, because what we've seen is that The entire climate has shifted from talk radio in the United States. You know, this actually began during President Obama's term, where the people were comparing him to a Nazi and things like this. The rhetoric became so heated during that period in the most extreme types of conspiracy theory that this extremist view became normalized in many corners, and to the extent that to take any other view was seen as politically correct, and you can lose credibility in some corners if you embrace diversity and tolerance. And so this is a very dangerous moment that is happening, but I think that there is the bright side that people are observing the uptick, and there are many corners of our society that are trying to find ways to respond to the problem that are constructive. Oftentimes, however, it runs into our question around free speech, and people seem to think that to in any way limit hate speech would be to limit our opportunities for freedom of speech. And I know that for your international audience, many countries around the world have a different view on the balance to be struck between values of equality and freedom of speech. And that's an ongoing conversation that we're having.
The only way some people say that we're going to change some of the narratives here, if we are intentional about talking about race and our differences and not just embracing or tolerating cultural differences, but celebrating those differences. What do you think has to take place in order? Do people have to sit down and have maybe some very uncomfortable conversations about race to move forward?
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what has to happen. And I think the uncomfortable conversations will be conversations about our history. We have a history around race that we've never directly confronted. I think the real answer, which you described, is the answer where we need to discuss what has happened in terms of our history around enslavement and Jim Crow, our history around Chinese exclusion in the 19th century, and the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, wherein many Japanese Americans were taken from their homes and put in essentially concentration camps. We need to talk about what happened to Native Americans in this country. We need to talk about what has happened to people of Latin American descent who have also faced discrimination throughout our history and language barriers all across the country in education. So I think those conversations will allow people to recognize the ethical and moral responsibility that we have as a nation. And that responsibility should lead to a desire to allow people to make things right through providing some more opportunity for equality and even recompense, or even some people in the political sphere have called recently for reparation. Now, that type of discussion, whether it takes place on a material level, financial reparation, or symbolic reparation, taking down the Confederate statues, replacing them with statues involving people of diverse descent, these types of things can make a difference.
Exactly. Well, I wanted to bring that up, and I think that's a very good example about the need for dialogue and bringing these painful stories to the fore in order to dispel misunderstandings. You talked about the Confederate statues we know they were in Charlottesville, mm-hmm. and that's why there was a rally to oppose them. It's time for them to go. With respect to those statues, which are obsolete is an understatement. Mm-hmm. They are sending the wrong messages. We're also seeing recently with the scandals facing top Virginia politicians, mm-hmm. we're talking about blackface is now in the news, and we need to explain what that is. The top politician, Ralph Northam, has been accused of engaging in this racist practice of blackface. People are shocked, but we're seeing so many examples of this. Other politicians are coming out saying, well, I did this in order to forestall criticism. Talk about, Justin, why is blackface so offensive? So people understand, you know, what's at stake here.
Oh, certainly. And I think it's important also because you do see blackface around the world today. And animation and in people blackening their face while acting. It's a type of mimicry where you exaggerate a feature of an individual for comedy, which is never in any sense anything except disrespect. The same way that you wouldn't exaggerate a Asian person's eyes by drawing a different shape of your eye, you wouldn't exaggerate an African-American skin color or exaggerate their lips by making their lips larger than they naturally should be. And of course, the added subtext in the case of blackface is the history of how it has been used here in the United States. Blackface is a type of tradition which came out of this approach to theater called minstrelsy. The premise behind Jim Crow itself, maybe this will help people make the connection. Jim Crow, which is the term we use for the system of segregation in the United States, which involved people being lynched, hung from trees based because of their race, people being denied access to higher education because of their race, people being assaulted. We use this shorthand Jim Crow to describe all those things. Jim Crow was actually a minstrel production, which came out of the South. People performed it during times going back to enslavement itself. And it had people dress up in these clothes, mimicking black people, acting ridiculous, acting slothful, lazy, unintelligent, acting in ways that fulfilled stereotypes, saying that we would eat certain types of food, watermelon or chicken, and we'd go crazy for these foods. These shows exaggerated these stereotypes, and it became so popular that it did become a household name, so to speak. And so people even then understood the negative connotations of blackface. However, they knew that it was wrong even then. And so that's why the system of segregation that was so horrific, that was such a human rights violation, was named after the blackface minstrel performers.
But as you said earlier, there are structural problems here in this country which disproportionately affect African Americans. And while blackface is extremely offensive, it's a form of humiliation, ridicule, and mockery, it's symbolic. We're also looking at words, deeds, policies. I mean, we have a Congressman, Steve King, whose actions and words have been deemed racist. He's been sanctioned. But we're seeing other trends as we close to talk about, which are very troubling, and I'd like you to address that. For example, a lot of voter suppression throughout this country, which disproportionately affect minority groups, whether African Americans or perhaps Hispanic Americans. And how do you reconcile, you know, these trends, which are very negative in the long run, with other more positive trends? Like, we're seeing very prominent African Americans who were going to run for president.
Yeah.
So these are interesting contrasts. How do you reconcile these trends?
One thing that I think to keep in mind is during slavery, we had prominent African Americans like Frederick Douglass who could gain access to the White House. During Jim Crow, we had our first black millionaire, Mary McLeod Bethune. We had Booker T. Washington visiting the White House. So individual accomplishments by prominent African Americans never had any relationship to our status as a people. They were always individuals who were prominent during the darkest of times. So I think the two can coexist. I think again, if you think about reform and retrenchment, we had a high watermark in the United States when the Voting Rights Act was passed, for example, during the Civil Rights Revolution, which allowed for widespread access to the franchise in the South in ways that never existed beforehand. And again, keeping up with our pattern, after this broad reform on voting rights, you have had a move towards retrenchment. Again, you cannot, and I think this is one aspect of critical race theory that's so instructive, you can't engage in retrenchment on the same terms. So there's not a move to completely recreate the poll tax where you mandated that African Americans had to pay to vote while others didn't. Or there was a question they used to ask African Americans when they voted, how many bubbles are in a bar of soap? And if you don't know how many bubbles are in a bar of soap, then you couldn't vote, while white Americans could vote no matter what. So they're not going to ask again, you know, how many bubbles are in a bar of soap. They come up with different mechanisms to do so that have not already been found unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. And that will be the grounds for retrenchment. And so for some of us, we know that voter ID has been an issue that people have argued over. Identification in general is something which not everybody has access to in the United States. Those who are poor, those who are people of color, those who are more likely to vote for a particular party, oftentimes are less likely to have identification. And so that disparity has been used as a ground to disenfranchise individuals. The disenfranchisement of people who have been incarcerated is another situation where we know there's a huge disparity in use of the tool of incarceration for people of color. And so by having a blanket ban on voting for all who have been imprisoned or in your state or who are imprisoned in your state, that disproportionately affects certain communities, which you think may be people of color, which you think may be people willing to vote in for one particular political party. So again, we've replaced this symbol of singling people out on the grounds of their race with the proxy of identifying communities that are disproportionately going to consist of one race or another. And, you know, those who are in prison disproportionately being black, those who are facing that situation disproportionately less likely to have identification. And those people are the ones who get signaled out for voter suppression. So it's a very difficult issue.
So, Justin, as we close, we're in 2019. You talked about progress, retrenchment. What is the current state of racial inequality in America in your eyes? And how much progress has there been in relation to last year, the year before? How do you see the state of play?
2019. So, again, there's certainly been progress. But one of my professors at Howard used to tell me that it all depends where you begin. So if you begin from slavery, everything since then seems like progress, right? If you begin from Jim Crow, then we should be happy. But the truth of the matter is people of African descent, just like other people who have begun their histories outside of American soil, have had much better times in the past. And where we are today, you know, we have, on a symbolic level, much to be concerned about. We should be concerned about the rhetoric. We should be concerned about the blackface, the statues, the Unite the Right marches. But more concerning than the symbols to me is the continuing inequality in a material level. The amount of incarceration, almost over two million people incarcerated in the United States, over half of them people of color. Even though, for example, black people make up about 12 or 13% of the population, over 30-35% of those incarcerated. The wealth gap, you know, for every black family that makes about, the average black family, I should say, makes about $1,700 in terms of their wealth each year. The average white family, over $117,000 in terms of their wealth. So the average white family has over 100 times the wealth of the average black family. So these are data and statistics that your listeners can look up. Those material gaps are what concern me the most, and we have to have the political will to even address those because of the way symbolic political discourse has shifted in recent years. We don't even see the political will to address these issues. I can go on, but you know, if you even think about some of the things involving the shutdown recently, there was no proposal to do anything addressing the wealth gap or do anything to address mass incarceration in exchange for a wall. This is not something that's on the political menu right now. And so our first step is to even get these problems on the political agenda, and then we can start to try to address those problems.
And, of course, that means looking toward 2020.
That's right.
Professor Justin Hansford is Associate Professor of Law and the Executive Director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center at Howard University. Justin, thank you for coming in, sharing your terrific insights.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guest. Our engineer was Jonah Cummings. And joining me on the program was VOA Senior TV Correspondent Chris Simpkins. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.